Tinder. You're a terrible sinner. You're a terrible sinner. You're a terrible sinner. You're a terrible sinner.
And hello, everybody, and welcome back to Sinful Cinema, episode number 5. Thanks again for joining us. I, of course, am TL Bug, and with me tonight is my wonderful co-host, the Reverend Phantom.
Hello, all.
There he is. He's feeling a little under the weather tonight, but you know what? We're still going podcast anyway. This has been... We're recording right as Black History Month ends.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're still not quite done with Black History Month.
No, we gotta send it off proper.
Yes, we do. So we've made a couple of top 10 lists for y'all tonight. So we're going to do 2 top 10 countdowns. I'm going to be counting down the top 10 neo-blaxploitation films. And what I mean by that is blaxploitation films that have come out after the era of blaxploitation films was over, so kind of post 1980 and beyond. Well, my friend Reverend Phantom, you're going to be doing just regular, straight up classic blaxploitation era.
Yeah, 70s specifically.
All right, the 70s era. So, I guess without further ado, let's just jump right into that. We're just going to start at 10 and go back and forth and. Find out what our number ones are in the blaxploitation genre. So, since your movies come out earlier than mine, why don't you kick us off with the number 10?
Okay, my number 10 is Black Belt Jones from 1974. Directed by Robert Klaus, starring Jim Kelly, Gloria Hendry, Scatman Crothers. Kind of just a silly little martial arts film, comedy, B-movie that's really fun. Stars, like I said, Jim Kelly from Enter the Dragon. And it's probably the silliest movie on the list, but it has to be on there because it's very entertaining.
Yeah, it is really good. That's one that I know I used to have in one of the oversized VHS boxes. And like a dumbass, I decided I'd sell that off on eBay some long time ago. And I did pick up some bread for it, but now I always wish I still had it.
Yeah.
All right, well, for my number 10, I'm going with a movie that definitely owes a lot to black exploitation pictures. And it just came out this past year. And really just hit DVD in the past couple of weeks, although I know a lot of people have been checking it out. And that is Black Dynamite, directed by Scott Sanders, and starring Michael Jai White as Black Dynamite. And speaking of silly, I mean, this is an extremely silly picture. Honestly, the first time I watched it, I thought it was just okay, and it took me another watch to really starting to get into the humor and everything.
Yeah, I've seen it several times, but it's funny that that's your number 10, and Black Belt Jones is my number 10, because it actually takes, I mean, it takes a lot from a lot of different blaxploitation films, but it really borrows quite a bit from Black Belt Jones.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely does, and it really borrows from a lot of things. I really enjoy it. There's just some lines in it that are just infinitely quotable.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I wish I could number the number of times I've said, but Black Dynamite, I sell drugs to the community. it just seems to happen.
Yeah, and it actually, they recycle a lot of the really good dialogue from some of the old blaxploitation movies as well. There's the scene, shut the fuck up while grown folks are talking.
Right.
Which is from the Mac, I believe.
Right.
But there's tons of great dialogue. And I did a review of this for B through Z, mm-hmm. and I pointed out how it is a spoof, but so you, lumping it in with like tons of other spoof movies that have come out recently is really unfair. It's really good.
Or even comparing it to a movie that didn't make my list, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's so broad in its tone and everything that, you know, it more has that Airplane kind of vibe or Naked Gun or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I know, Black Dynamite really plays it straight up. It's just
right.
funny.
Right. It very well could have been a blaxploitation movie from the 70s. If it didn't have some right. like familiar faces in it and somebody showed me it and I didn't know anything about it, I probably would have said, oh yeah, what? This come out in 74?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, it definitely looks like it. And I hear they're going to make another one, so I hope they do.
Right on.
So tell me about your number 9.
All right, coming to number 9, I got Cotton Comes to Harlem from 1970. Directed by Ossie Davis, the actor.
Really?
Who, yeah, most a lot of people would know from Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. He's been in tons of things, but he was quite prominent in that. Stars Raymond St. Jackson as Coffin Ed Johnson and Godfrey Cambridge as Gravedigger Jones. And also stars Red Fox, kind of a two pre-Dirty Harry style cops that track down some stolen money hidden in a bale of hay. But it is, again, this is going to be repetitiveness on this list. It's just damn entertaining from beginning to end, you know, just really great characters. I mean, Coffin Ed and Gravedigger Jones, I mean, how awesome is that?
It sounds great. This is one that I've actually never caught up with. I've known about it for years and probably seen the box 100 times and just somehow never seen that one.
And Dirty Harry, I mean, this is pre-Dirty Harry, and it that character really is kind of a morphing of these two characters, which is funny because they're black characters, but yeah, there was a definite influence on Dirty Harry from this film.
Well, that's definitely something I'm going to have to check out, especially knowing that Ossie Davis directed it. It kind of just makes it even more something I'm going to have to look at.
Oh, yeah.
Well, my number 9 is another film from 2009. I guess 2009 was a good year for neo-blaxploitation. And the movie I'm talking about is Obsessed, directed by Steve Schill, and starring Idris Elba and Beyonce Knowles. And if you don't remember this one, this is basically Idris Elba plays Beyonce's husband, and he has Ali Larder from Heroes is trying to get in his pants, and Beyonce finally has enough of it, and she just finally snaps and takes out that white woman. I mean, as soon as I saw the trailer for this one, I knew I had to see it, because I was just like, wow, there's an exploitation picture if I ever seen one. And honestly, it was good, mindless fun. I really enjoyed it. Beyonce was good. Idris Elba, who I've enjoyed on The Wire and his small stint on The Office, he's always seems really good. So yeah, I really enjoy it. It's stupid fun. It's basically Fatal Attraction with a black couple, but instead of, you know, rabbits going in pots, instead Beyonce gets to kick Ali Larder's ass.
Yeah, I remember when this came out. I've not seen it, but yeah, based on your recommendation, I'd probably check it out. But I remember when it first came out, I was like, so that's another Fatal Attraction ripoff, and I don't think I've even given it another thought.
Right. You know, it's one to check out. Like I said, don't expect too much from it. I mean, I would probably only give it maybe a 2 or something like that out of 5. But, you know, it's definitely, it's fun, stupid kind of enjoyable thing. And the, you know, the fight between Beyonce and Ali Larder is worth the price of admission entirely.
I do remember that from the advertisements, how the fights kind of seemed really over the top.
Oh yeah, it was kind of, the fight almost reminds me of the Vivica Fox bride fight in Kill Bill Volume 1.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it doesn't quite go that far over the top, right, but pretty close. So, yep, that's about all I have to say about Obsessed.
All right. Well, my number 8 is probably a not as well known as some of these others on the list, but it's Trouble Man from 1972, directed by Ivan Dixon, one of the few actual black directors to do blaxploitation. He also did The Spook Who Sat by the Door, another really good film. Stars Robert Hooks, another name that really probably a lot of people weren't familiar with. He started in a TV series in the late 60s, and now I'm forgetting what it was. NYPD, I think, if I'm thinking of the right movie, the right guy. Kind of a tough-as-nails PI, gets caught between a gang war, and Marvin Gaye provides a soundtrack, which is really good. And it's, I'm sure it probably got, you know, people probably thought it was just a rip-off of Shaft, but it's really nothing like Shaft, and Hooks is just a badass in this film.
Yeah, I really like this one, and like I say, the Marvin Gaye score is a lot of what sells it for me. Although Robert Hooks is great, and if I remember my trivia right, then they call him Mr. T in this movie, and that's where Mr. T got Mr. T from.
Right. Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting little connection with that movie as well. I really like Trouble Man. I think it's one of the better ones and one that people don't get to hear about a lot.
Yeah, I was definitely late to check it out because, it was directed by somebody I wasn't familiar with at the time, and I didn't know who Robert Hooks was, and it just kind of sounded like a plot line that was recycled from other blaxploitation films. So that I saw Ivan Dixon's other film, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, which was really good, and so I was like, oh, I guess I'll give Trouble Man a shot, and I'm glad I did.
But The Spook Who Sat by the Door is kind of less blaxploitation and more of a straight-up drama, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those, I mean, and there were several films like that that kind of got lumped with blaxploitation, even though it really wasn't.
Yeah, like Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich and movies like that.
Right.
It's kind of got lumped in, but it's not really the same thing.
Right.
I hear you. All right, well, at number 8 on my list is a film from 1996 starring Jada Pinkett Smith, Queen Latifah, and Vivica A. Fox. And I'm talking about Set It Off. If you don't remember this one, this is four black women in the LA Projects. They get tired of being a victim of circumstance and decide to hold up banks. And I really enjoy this one. I mean, not only does it have a lot of good-looking ladies in it, but it's a pretty fun movie. And the weirdest thing to me, now looking back on it, is that John C. McGinley, which a lot of people will know from Scrubs, is kind of the asshole doctor, plays the police detective who's after them, which seems like really weird casting now. He's really good in it, but, I mean, now looking back on it, it's hard to imagine him as, like, a police officer out to break up black women robbing banks.
Yeah.
And this one was directed by F. Gary Gray. He also directed Friday, which is another pretty good one, too.
Yeah, I dig the Friday movies.
Yeah, I like the first one. After that, they kind of...
The second one was kind of okay. Then I think I think there is a third one, isn't there?
I think so. I think in there.
That says it all.
Friday
though.
And next Friday, and I don't know, Friday after
obviously
next. Obviously,
didn't
not
leave
sure.
an impression. So,
no, I mean, I think there might be a third one, but I don't really even remember it at all. But yeah, Set It Off. Pretty fun movie, and definitely worth your time to check out.
All right, my number 7 is The Mac, directed by Michael Campos, starring Max Julian. Pretty underrated actor, and Richard Pryor. Pimp named Goldie's rise and fall in the 1970s Los Angeles, and it's with a terrific score by Willie Hutch, who would also do Foxy Brown, and as well as The Last Dragon. But The Mac is, again, I mean, it is blaxploitation, but it kind of borders on kind of just being a regular drama as well. It's not really heavy on the action or anything like that, but it's a good flick. Richard Pryor's was really high during the making of the film, and it really shows. Oh, yeah.
It does. It's been a long time since I've seen The Mac. Probably almost 10 years. And so I don't particularly remember it, but I don't remember loving it when I first saw it, so it's probably one I need to go back and check on again, because I think I probably was expecting something else.
Right, yeah, the first time I saw it, I wasn't really that blown away either, but something brought me back, and I've come back a couple times since, so, but yeah, it's a good flick.
Yeah, definitely one I should probably go back and check out again. So coming in at number 7, I have one of the best titles of all time, and that's because you can put it after anything that ends with 2, and I'm talking about Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, from 1984, directed by Sam Furstenberg, who also directed the American Ninja movies, among a lot of things, or at least the first couple. Starring Adolfo Quinones, Lucinda Dickey, and Michael Chambersand. Of course, this is the whole, you know, breakdancers have to save the rec center.
Mm-hmm.
And Ozone and Turbo are going to breakdance until they don't close it down. This is one that I have great memories of from my childhood, even more than Breakin'.
Yeah.
Or Beat Street. And I really like this movie because it brings back a lot of good memories of putting on my parachute pants and getting the jam box out and laying out a really big piece of cardboard and trying to spin on my back.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I won't deny I was there doing the same thing, too. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of movie that was on like, it seemed like it was on cable like 10 times a week.
Oh yeah, yeah, no doubt.
And I watched it every time, so yeah, that's definitely a childhood favorite. I've not seen it probably since I was like 10, but yeah, it's... Right.
I actually just finally rewatched this earlier this year. It had been quite a while, and I didn't think it would hold up, and I ended up still enjoying it as much as I ever did. And I think it's because it just took me right back.
Yeah, that's good to know. Yeah, no, that, you know, as far as part 2, Electric Boogaloo, yeah, you can pretty much add that to anything. That's...
Oh, yeah. I mean, anytime anything part 2 comes out, immediately Electric Boogaloo goes behind it for me. So it's always like, Jaws 2, Electric Boogaloo. You know, whatever it is, right. It doesn't matter. It's,
yep.
It's Electric Boogaloo just goes along with 2. That's all it is.
All right. Well, my number 6 is Ralph Bakshi's Coonskin from 1975, also known as Street Fight, because I'm sure the original title was offensive to some folks. It stars the voices of Scatman Crothers, Barry White, Charles Gordon, and Philip Michael Thomas.
No, that's weird.
Animated blaxploitation. Yeah, it's sort of a spoof of the Song of the South, Disney's Song of the South. It follows the exploits of Brother Rabbit and his friends Brother Bear, who is voiced by White, and Preacher Fox, who is Gordon. And this is my favorite Bakshi movie. It's I saw it as a teenager, and it kind of just stuck with me. I found it through some of Bakshi's other films like Fritz the Cat and stuff like that, and I kind of stumbled upon this. And if it's very politically incorrect.
Oh, sure. As most of Bakshi's animated films in that period were.
Exactly, and this one kind of just tops them all. And but that being said, it's also a really, really touching film in spots. It's got like really good like urban poetry and. And of course, I'm a big fan of his animation, his style, and the way he made the characters move and their body movements. It was, I guess to some people it would probably look kind of cheesy, but, you know, given, you know, the era of animation at that time, it was pretty state-of-the-art shit.
Yeah, I've not seen this one. I'm a really big fan of Bakshi in general. What's funny is that you mentioned that it was called Street Fight, and I knew I had a video of Bakshi's that I hadn't seen before, and I look right over here, and it's Street Fight. So I guess I do have it to see, but I have not seen it yet. But I'm a big fan of his. Fritz the Cat is one of my favorite films. just in general, because I find that film incredibly hilarious. So I'm going to, this is another one I'm going to have to, now that I know I have it right here, we'll have to check it out real shortly.
And to anybody else curious, there, I haven't checked recently, but it's been available on YouTube. Kind of one of those things, if you can watch it in 10 parts kind of a thing. But right. I believe it is built on YouTube for people to watch, because it is not on DVD.
That's a shame, hopefully. He can get, I mean, all his stuff should be on DVD, because it's definitely a seminal time in animation.
Right.
So hopefully they'll get that cleared up soon. Well, coming in at number 6 on my list, back to the 90s again. And with the 1997 film starring Lawrence Fishburne, Vanessa Williams, and the very evil Tim Roth. And I'm talking about Hoodlum. This is a movie I really enjoy, and not just because you get to call Lawrence Fishburne Bumpy the whole time, but I mean, this is a historical film. You know, how historically accurate it is, I don't know, but it's basically about Ellsworth Bumpy Johnson and how he kind of forms or keeps, you know, the numbers racket going in the black neighborhoods and doesn't let Dutch Schultz, who Tim Roth plays, take it over in Harlem. And I really like it. I mean, I think it's to me, it goes back to films like Black Caesar, where they kind of took that, you know, 1930s, 1940s gangster film and updated it for, you know, the black exploitation audience. You know, this just is kind of the extension of that, but actually taking a true story of a black gangster and doing it with it.
Yeah, I've seen this one. It's kind of an underrated film, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I really like Fishburne in pretty much anything except for The Matrix. other than that, I really like to see him in pretty much any films, and he puts in a hell of a performance here, and Tim Roth definitely does, and Andy Garcia is also in this one as Lucky Luciano, and he's very good as well. I mean, it's a lot of good performances. It's a heck of a cast, and I think it got overlooked when it came out because a lot of people kind of went, oh, that looks stupid.
Yeah.
But it's one people should go back and check out. It's also directed by Bill Duke, who played Mac in Predator.
Oh, yeah?
So another actor.
I did not know that.
Showing up as a director here.
Right on. Yeah, that's definitely a good one. My number 5 is Foxy Brown from 1974, directed by Jack Hill, and starring Pam Grier, and, you know, Sid Haig's in there as well. Foxy Brown seeks revenge when her government agent boyfriend Michael is shot down by gangsters. Planned as a sequel to Coffee, but it's not really. It's kind of a standalone flick, and another score by Willie Hutch.
Yeah, another good one. I mean, you pretty much can't go wrong with Jack Hill.
Right.
I mean, no matter if he's making blaxploitation or exploitation or action or whatever, it doesn't really matter. I mean, his movies are just pretty much gold all the way through.
Yeah, he makes some damn fine films. I mean, they're very entertaining. I mean, it's total exploitation, all of it, I've not seen a Jack Hill film, but I was disappointed after watching.
No, I haven't either. I mean, every single film I've seen of him, I really love. And Foxy Brown, I think might have been my introduction to Pam Grier. I'm pretty sure I saw that one before I saw Coffee or any of the other ones. Mm-hmm. That was kind of my introduction to her. And yeah, definitely a good film.
Yeah, I mean, Pam Grier, I mean, can't really... I mean, she's really good in this one. I think she's, even though I like Coffee more than this film, I think she actually gets to go off a little bit more in Foxy Brown and become kind of stand toe-to-toe with guys like Roundtree and Fred Williams and stuff like that, and become her own kind of badass mofo.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And it's a good movie all around, and I would say how great she looks in it, but apparently my wife says the last time I talked about Pam Grier, I said that like 8 times. So I will not say that.
Alrighty.
So I'll just, you know, digress and move on to number five. Mm-hmm. Number five, kind of an odd pick, probably. Probably not a film a lot of people have seen, but it's the 1995 film Devil in a Blue Dress, directed by Carl Franklin and starring Denzel Washington and Don Cheadle. This is based off a series of books by African-American writer Walter Mosley about his kind of detective Easy Rawlings. He's not really a detective. He just kind of does favors for people in the community. And I'm a big fan. I've read all of the Easy Rawlings books. And this is the only movie I know of that's been made out of any of them. It's a period piece. It's set in 1948, and basically Easy Rawlings is looking for work, and a stranger asks him to locate a missing woman. Sounds like a surefire way to get some cash, but Rawlings gets more than he bargained for and soon becomes entangled in a murder mystery. What's really great about it to me is not just Denzel's performance, which, you know, he's always pretty much solid, but Don Cheadle is just a powerhouse in this. In the books, Easy has a friend named Mouse Alexander who's kind of in and out of jail and always in trouble and everything. And, like, I never really could get a peg in my mind on what he looked like or what he acted like or anything. And as soon as I saw Cheadle in the film, I was like, oh, I know that's Mouse. And he was just perfect. I mean, he's such a he's kind of a diminutive dude, but he just really has this vicious streak in the movie. It's just perfect for the character.
Yeah, Cheadle's really good. What year did this come out?
No, this is 1995, so this is fairly early in his career.
That's what I was gonna say. He hadn't quite taken off yet.
No, this was well, I guess he had been in some stuff, but I mean, he wasn't Don Cheadle, right? Like capital Don Cheadle, like he'd become when he did some of his more recent work. So this was kind of one that got him noticed, I think, by a lot of people.
I've not seen this one. I do remember it though, but yeah, I've not seen this one.
It's good. It's worth checking out. And if you like good mystery books, definitely check out the Walter Mosley books. I can definitely say that there's probably, I think there's 10 or 12 of them, and I really like all of them. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, we mentioned this one earlier. Number four is Black Caesar from 1973. Oh, yeah. Larry Cohen directed, and starring mm-hmm. the great Fred Williamson, the Hammer.
Yep.
Former shoeshine boy becomes the first black man accepted into the mafia, then his rise and inevitable fall, and with a incredible score by James Brown.
Yeah, definitely. Now, this is an updated version of the 1930s film Little Caesar with Edward G. Robinson. Right. And I think the translation really works very, very well.
Yeah, I just recently did a review of this as well, and one of the things I pointed out in the film, not to take anything away from it, but it's such an epic movie that doesn't really get an epic treatment from mm-hmm. Cohen. It very well could have been a Scorsese, Ford Coppola type gangster epic, but it's squeezed right. into like an hour and a half time right. frame. It's like, so there's like, you really like go through his life pretty quick when things could have been fleshed out, but nonetheless, still a very well-made and very entertaining blaxploitation film.
Yeah, definitely quality and fun to watch. In the past I've watched Little Caesar and Black Caesar back to back, and very interesting to watch where they overlap and are the same movie and where they deviate wildly. Mm-hmm. But very interesting. And Larry Cohen, there's a director that we're going to talk a little bit more about. I believe it's next week. Are we going to be doing Larry Cohen next week?
I believe so. Yeah,
that seems like it. We're doing his first picture, Bone. So come back and check out a little more Larry Cohen talk next week.
Yes.
All right. Well, for my number four, I'm going to give it up for the Tippy Ties. Because I'm talking about 2001's Pootie Tang. Directed by Louis C.K., starring Lance Carruthers, Chris Rock, Jennifer Coleridge, Robert Vaughn, and Wanda Sykes. Pootie Tang is a crime fighter and recording sensation who speaks an indecipherable language, but to children everywhere, he's a heroic role model. In this feature-length outing, Pootie mixes it up with an evil CEO who wants kids to smoke, drink, and eat fast food. But he's going to take care of them with his belt. It nearly ranked higher on my list because this is a movie that I can just watch over and over and over and over and never get tired of.
Yeah, you've already quoted it a couple times to me in the past, so yeah, I can tell that this is one of your favorites. I've not seen it since it probably first came out. I should probably check it out again pretty soon.
I do like it, and just generally in everyday life, this is another one of those quotable films that between me and my wife, like every couple days, you know, quotes like, "What, a woman can't dress up fancy and stand on the street corner?" Like, things like that'll just come out. So, if you haven't seen Pootie Tang, then I'll sign your pity on the runny kind and check it out.
Okay, where were we? Number three.
We're at number three. I totally threw you off with that.
Yeah. Number three is Shaft, 1971, directed by Gordon Parks. Another rare black director of blaxploitation. He also did the sequel, Shaft's Big Score, and stars Richard Roundtree, who's the private dick.
As who?
Who's the private dick that's the sex machine to all the chicks.
Shut your mouth.
As I'm just talking about Shaft.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, this one is, I was actually kind of a late bloomer to this film. I've been watching blaxploitation for years, but for some reason I just, like, avoided this one for some reason, and I'm not sure why, but I saw it probably only a year and a half ago or something like that. And,
oh, wow.
And became an instant fan, and, I mean, excellent score by Isaac Hayes. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost legendary score by Isaac Hayes. I mean, so it's almost more known than the actual film is.
Right. Yeah, I think this was one of the first one or two that I saw. And I think I actually started getting into these movies because I started getting into Isaac Hayes via Henry Rollins, but that's a long story. I really love this movie. I mean, the soundtrack is just, of course, incredible. And if you've never seen the footage of Isaac performing the theme from Shaft at the Academy Awards, I'm sure it's on YouTube. That's something that you definitely need to get into your brain.
Yeah, Isaac Hayes was quite the performer.
He was. I mean, it's kind of... I don't really know what's happened to Mr. Hayes in the last few years, other than Scientology. it's a shame that he's not still cranking out grooves like he did in the 70s.
Now, I know I've accused of killing people off before the time, but didn't he die?
Did he? Okay. Right, maybe he did. Yeah, he did. He did die. All right. Well, yeah, that's right. He did die.
Okay.
Well, before he died... he still wasn't cranking out grooves.
Honestly, you're saying that. I'm like, did he die? Like, I'm not, because I said this. I thought the same thing about Roger Ebert here.
No, he's not dead. He just can't talk.
Yeah, it's like, but I could have, because the past few years, so many freaking celebrities have died. It's been hard to actually keep track.
It does seem that way. Like we got to some tipping point where celebrities got a certain age, like all of them at once, and they all just started dying off in droves.
Right.
All right. Well, I guess we'll move on to my number three. And speaking of music, I'm going to talk about the 1985 film Crush Groove, directed by Michael Schultz, starring Blair Underwood as Russell Walker. Might as well just say Russell Simmons. Mm-hmm. And Rick Rubin as Rick. Interesting name he got there. The plot of it is Russell, a manager of struggling rap artists, borrows money from the villain Jay in order to make ends meet. But after his clients become successful, Russell can't pay back the loan, much to Jay's consternation. Groovy musical about struggling record company, a large city. This cult classic explores the 1980s hip-hop underground via the music of Sheila E., Run DMC, Fat Boys, Curtis Blow, and many more. And all of those groups appear in the movie not just as musical acts, but as themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Russell Simmons even appears in the movie as another character, not playing himself, because Blair Underwood's busy playing him. But a great little movie, and Rick Rubin, you know, just obviously they just said, well, just be yourself, because he obviously, very obviously was. I think the Beastie Boys might be in this too at some point.
I think
You know, definitely, you know, if you grew up in the early 80s and you loved Run DMC and the Fat Boys and all these guys, this is a movie you've just pretty much got to see. Because, I mean, it stars all of them in kind of straight-up roles, not like the Fat Boys and Disorderlies. It's really well-made and really fun.
Yeah, it's bringing up movies like this and Breakin' really mm-hmm. get you to thinking about... I mean, those are probably like some of the movies that actually got me into blaxploitation, if you think about it, because some of my early experiences with, like, urban-themed films... You know.
Right. It's kind of funny to just even think about that, you know, it wasn't that long ago in 85 when rap and hip hop were so new
right.
that we had to have like a movie about how rap and hip hop was just getting started or breakdancing was getting started and whatnot like that. So it's kind of interesting, you know, like, you know, during our parents' generation, you know, rock and roll kind of got its start. You know, a lot of our parents are a little younger than say Bill Haley in the Comets years, but still in the generation of people who are like 30 to 40 now, you know, rap really got its start right within our generation. Mm-hmm. We've been able to see the arc of it as it went along. And I think it's really interesting to go back and watch this. I'm a very weird musical taste. I like everything, but mm-hmm. I mostly listen to folk and hip hop. So, yeah, what can I say? And a lot of that comes from, you know, just all my life I've, you know, had, you know, Fat Boys and Beastie Boys and Curtis Blow and all these, you know, great performers from the 80s were people I listened to in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just the same way with music. I'm kind of into everything, but yeah, I was definitely into this kind of music, as well as other things as well. But I mean, I definitely had a place in my heart for hip hop and rap and stuff like that, especially the stuff that came out of the 80s was just so good. It's just fun music. I mean, it changed somewhere along the way when it became the gangster rap, which, you know,
yeah.
But there was something about the 80s rap music that was just a good time.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So now we're getting into brass tacks. So hit me with your number two.
Number two would be Coffee.
Oh, there we go.
73, but directed by Jack Hill and with Pam Grier again. Just a great revenge flick with Pam Grier looking great and another kick-ass score from Willie Hutch. But yeah, this is no, it's by Roy Ayers, not Hutch. Sorry, I was looking at Foxy Brown still. But yeah, this is just an all-around. Just entertaining flick, and Pam Grier is great in it.
Yep, I think this is my favorite of the Pam Grier flicks as well. And definitely, if I was making my blaxploitation list, this would probably come in at one or two as well. It is just a solid film all around, very entertaining, just. Fun stuff, and I mean, we've already extolled the virtues of Jack Hill, so not much more to say there.
Yep.
All right. Well, coming in at number two on my list, back in the 90s again, with 1995's Dead Presidents, directed by the Hughes Brothers, starring Lawrence Tate, Keith David, Chris Tucker, and Freddie Rodriguez. It's a film about a group of Vietnam vets who come back and unable to find work or anything, they decide to rob a shipment of weathered money that's being taken out of circulation, literally money that's going to be taken by the Federal Reserve and burnt. And I just, This was the Hughes brothers' second film. They made Menace to Society first, mm-hmm. which is a pretty solid film, but not one of my favorites. But I really think they hit their stride with Dead Presidents. I mean, from Dead Presidents to From Hell, and even I recently saw The Book of a Lie, and I really enjoyed that as well. I think there are a couple of great directors, and I think this film, from top to bottom, from the acting and the direction to the incredible, incredible funk score, the music they chose for this film was just perfect. I just really love it. And the iconic look of kind of the white face they put on when they go rob the money is just always kind of sticks in my mind.
Yeah, this is a great one. Yeah, if I was making my own list of post Blaxploitation movies, yeah, this would definitely be one or two as well. So, yeah, good film. Hughes Brothers, great. Just like you said, very iconic with the makeup and very well made film.
Yeah, and I think the Hughes Brothers are really came out of their tradition of, you know, genre filmmaking, as evidenced by some of their stuff later that people might not have expected from them as much. And I think it shows a lot in Dead Presidents, kind of, that they knew a lot about the blaxploitation genre, obviously, and kind of incorporated elements into that, into their own kind of dramatic world.
Yeah, they're definitely big fans of the genre. There's a behind-the-scenes doc on the Mac where they're talking to a bunch of different people about the film, and there come the people that they talk to, and they're filming them while they're watching the movie, and they're just like mm-hmm. almost like repeating the whole movie like verbatim.
Nice. Definitely, I mean, they're a couple of my favorite filmmakers. I mean, they've had a solid catalog throughout. I think every, you know, just about every movie they've made's been a pretty stunning little picture. So I just wish they'd almost make more films, because they don't make enough for me.
Yeah.
So now here we go. We're at the moment of truth.
Yeah. If anybody's been paying attention over at my blog, they already know my number one, which is Truck Turner from 1974. Directed by Jonathan Kaplan, who also a really, really good director. He also did Over the Edge and The Accused with Jodie Foster, among quite a few other films. Stars Isaac Hayes, Yaphet Kotto, and Nichelle Nichols, Scatman Crothers. Isaac Hayes plays a badass skip tracer, and he also provides a great score, which to me is basically just as good as this one for Shaft. So. But yeah, so if anybody wants to know more about that, my last review on my site, and it's reverendphantom.com, but that's definitely, without a doubt, after I saw it, I was like, that's the best Blaxploitation movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, I really like this one too. I don't know if it would come in my number one spot, but it would definitely be at the top five. A great movie, a great cast. I love Yaphet Kotto. I mean, he's you know, Isaac Hayes, wonderful in the movie. Yaphet Kotto is just great. I just like to see him in anything. I love, as a Star Trek fan, I love seeing Nichelle Nichols in this movie, because it is such a completely different role for her.
Yeah.
As like the head of these prostitutes. And you know, she's definitely not the Uhura that you're used to, and if Kirk had seen this Uhura, man, that first interracial kiss would have happened a lot earlier. I'm pretty sure of that.
Yeah, she's pretty mean in this one.
Yeah, she is. She really is. But it's definitely a different look and a different kind of just tone overall to her. So I really do enjoy this film as well. And your review was, as usual, hilarious and kept me laughing.
Well, that's what says something about the film too. I mean, this is actually, even though I wouldn't consider it a comedy, it's got some genuine laughs in it.
Oh yeah, definitely. I do think it does. So. All right, well, that just leaves us with my number one, and I'm going to stay with the 90s on this one. And I'm going to talk about the 1992 film Juice, starring Omar Epps and Tupac Shakur. The plot of this one is four Harlem guys kick their troublesome habits, and they're one's trying to be a rap DJ, the others are trying to figure out where they fit in their life, but Q, played by Omar Epps, gets pressured into a store robbery instigated by Bishop, Tupac Shakur. And of course things go horribly wrong, and Bishop shoots the store owner, and you know, then he gets incredibly paranoid, and he's starting to take the other guys out, and Q start, you know, trying to win this DJ contest. And in the early 90s there was just a slew of these movies that came out. There was, I think it kind of started with New Jack City, Menace to Society, like I mentioned earlier, and Juice, and out of those that came out, Juice just to me was just perfectly made, had a great look to it. Omar Epps is not somebody who I really love. Like, I don't think I've seen him in hardly anything else I've liked at all. But he really hits it on the nail here. And Tupac, you know, I consider him an entertaining rapper. But he was so much of a better actor.
Yeah.
And he's really good. Very frightening and threatening in this one. And, I mean, just all around, I enjoy this. This is directed by Ernest R. Dickinson, and he actually has a little other genre cred, because after this film, he went on to direct Tales from the Crypt: Demon Knight, so which is another favorite of mine. Then he directed Surviving the Game, but we won't talk about that. I mean, this is a great movie, and when it comes to those early 90s, kind of neo-blaxploitation pictures that came out when, kind of, that kind of movie was on an upswing, I just think this is, just a 10 out of 10. I mean, it's just a very fine movie.
I'd probably need to see it again. That's another one I probably haven't seen since it first came out, but I do remember liking it, though, so.
Yeah, it's good stuff, so. Well, there you go, folks. There's 20 movies. If you haven't seen these 20 movies, these are 20 movies highly endorsed by the fellas here at Sinful Cinema. So you should definitely go and check them out. And if there's some we missed, which I'm sure there are, I know Mr. Phantom was a little surprised I did not have The Last Dragon on my list.
Mm-hmm.
Which I do really like. I guess in my mind it kind of plays out more just like a martial arts picture, but I suppose it is neo-blaxploitation. I was a little surprised that the Reverend didn't include Superfly or any Rudy Ray Moore over there.
Yeah, and the reason for that being is, well, one, with Superfly, not a really big fan of the film. I love the score by Curtis Mayfield, my love for that film kind of ends with the score. And as far as Rudy Ray Moore's films, while I love his films, I don't think any of his movies stack up to the 10 that were on my list, though.
I hear you. I mean, I enjoy Superfly, but if you take away the score, there's not a whole lot there.
Right.
I mean, it really is that advertisement for cocaine use. I really think it's the pairing of Mayfield's score with Superfly that makes it a great film. Probably would come in about number 3 or 4 on my list. And Dolomite is absolutely one of my favorites. Probably also show up pretty high on my list. Now, after Dolomite, his movies definitely get pretty shaky.
As far as like Superfly, though, as far as like movies about pimps, I mean, The Mac and even Willie Dynamite are higher up on my list than even with Superfly.
Yeah, Willie Dynamite actually, honestly, would probably come in at my number one.
Oh yeah,
that's my favorite blaxploitation picture. I really love seeing Gordon from Sesame Street walking around in big giant furry hats. I love the kind of fall that he takes in that one from being the biggest pimp in town to not hardly having two nickels to rub together.
The pimp gathering in Black Dynamite is totally borrowed from, yes, Willie Dynamite.
Yes, definitely taken right out there. And the ending of Willie Dynamite always makes me think that he just went straight from that movie into being Gordon. Like, because he's like playing football with kids on the street and whatnot. And it just makes me think he went like, you know what? My real name's Gordon.
Well, it would have been funny if the song at the end was, you know, Sunny Days.
Yes, it would. It would have been good. All right. Well, folks, like we said, that's 20 movies for you to check out. Let us know what your favorite blaxploitation pictures are, or neo-blaxploitation, or even older movies that we didn't get into, because there are a lot of great classic movies featuring black cast too. So send us an email at sinfulcinema@charter.net, and we would love to hear what you have to say. So now we're going to take a little break. You're going to hear a little message from b-through-z.com, and then you're going to hear a trailer for the first film we're going to talk about tonight, and that is Mark Savage's Marauders.
Hello, freaks! Reverend Phantom here, and I want to tell you about one of the best horror and exploitation websites around.
B-through-z.com.
B-through-z features interviews with the genre stars that you love, and tons of great reviews and articles written by people with a passion, if not a sick love, for horror, exploitation, and B-movies in general. B-through-z.com is more than a website. It's a horror fanzine that releases a new online issue every month. It's just like a horror magazine that you'd pick up at a store, but it's only available online, and best of all, it's free. In this day and age, with the economy as shitty as it is, who can't appreciate that? If you haven't checked out B-through-Z.com yet, what the hell are you waiting for? Get thee to B-through-Z and see what all the buzz is about, and tell them that TL Bug and the Reverend sent ya. Later, freaks.
Mark Savage's first film, Marauders, and actually both films we're going to be talking about are films by Mark Savage, so I thought I'd start off here by telling you a little bit about Mr. Savage. He comes from Australia, and he's a independent filmmaker. His bio says he has insatiable lust for cinema and telling tall stories, and he's cranked out over 100 shorts, 7 features, it's more than 7 now, it's dated, and numerous projects beyond categorization. He's made everything from action to comedy to kind of really dark children's films. It says he's a fiercely and proudly independent director. He's financed most of his shorts himself, and enlisted like-minded patrons of the dark to buy back the other half. He works with a loyal, professional, dedicated crew of proud, honest misfits, and he has no tolerance for poor lighting, bad framing, or technically shoddy work in any film, especially his own, no matter what the budget. And I think we're going to talk about how that kind of shows. He has a deep love for European and Asian cinema, and has written about his cinematic obsessions for some newspapers, Asian Cult Cinema Magazine, FilmNet, and he also runs a blog, but we're not sure whether he wants us to out what blog he runs, so if you do want to know what that is, shoot us an email and maybe we can get that information to you. Also, a little interesting is thing is bio, it says from age 5, Mark wore an eye patch for 4 years. and he credits this with his gradual slide towards all things bizarre, monstrous, dangerous, taboo, and beautiful. So that's kind of an interesting little tidbit about that. And so the first film we're going to talk about is Marauders, and I'm going to throw it over to the Rev for a little synopsis.
All right. Now, before I get into this, now the trailer you just heard doesn't have a whole lot of dialogue in it, and believe me, there's more than just the word bitch in the whole film.
There is, yes.
The trailer just listen to what you hear is bitch.
There is more than the word bitch, that's definitely one of the top words in this film if you were counting.
Yes. All right. Well, Marauders is about two sociopaths who go on a killing spree and are interrupted when a man accidentally runs over one of the psycho's legs, leaving him badly injured. They stalk the man and his girlfriend to the countryside, leaving a trail of destruction behind him. Soon they find the country townsfolk are not so easy to push around.
Yep, that pretty much sums it up. This was, as I believe, this was shot on video.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's amazing how good this film looks.
Yes.
You know, being shot on video, what year was this?
86.
I mean, you know, that had to be one of those giant video cameras that actually took a VHS in it.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine it would have been anything else or a beta or something. I mean, but it looks absolutely fabulous, especially for, you know, a first full-length effort and everything. He said this was self-funded with his brother Colin, who also stars in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he's Emilio.
Right.
A quote from him says that it was an angry and cinematic kick in the teeth to a country that saw censorship as valid. And I can definitely see, you know, kind of the angry filmmaker coming out.
Oh yeah.
There's definitely more than a little homage to movies like Last House on the Left and I Spit on Your Grave and things like that in here.
Yeah, it's got a great 70s exploitation style, but with an 80s look.
Yeah. It has an 80s look.
Yeah, Colin's hair is
wow.
Yeah.
I mean, his hair, Emilio's hair, is just like, I'm not sure if they would have let him in Flock of Seagulls, because I think they might have said that is too much hair for us.
I find it kind of ironic that he now sports a bald head.
I know. It's kind of funny. Like, did all your hair go away? Because you sure had a lot of it.
Well, he was probably pretty rough with it. That was a lot of Aquanet for a hairstyle like that.
It must have been. I mean, it is just massive, and really was not like anything else I had ever seen before.
Well, the funny thing about that is, as soon as you pop the movie in, it's like there's no doubt what decade that film came from. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, the 80s.
Yeah, not at all, because it definitely has that feel the whole time and everything. If there's, I think the one thing that it might suffer from is the 80s soundtrack. The kind of synthy score that it's saddled with, and other than that, you know, it does definitely. You know, these were not professional actors.
Mm-mm.
You know, like we said, Colin Savage, the director's brother, stars in it, as well as Zero Montana as the other psycho, JD.
And Zero Montana never. I don't believe he ever made another film after that. I think that was his one and only.
Yes, it was, he did have a serious pair of assless pants in this movie.
And I don't think, even just saying assless pants, I think people are automatically thinking, like, you know, like chaps, but no, that's,
no,
no, it was,
no, we're talking about jeans with just the ass cut out of them.
I mean, the back thigh, even.
Yeah, I'm not sure why or what kind of fashion statement it was, or if people, he really wanted people to see his bright red drawers? I don't know.
I think it just kind of like was supposed to be, these guys really don't give a fuck about anything, not even how stupid they look with their pants ripped.
Right. We don't care. We'll rip the ass out of our pants.
Right.
But both the characters, JD and Emilio, they are definitely a couple pieces of work.
Mm.
I found them very entertaining and the kind of their interplay and everything. Like I said, these are not professional actors, but I thought they did a pretty good job pulling off the kind of dumbass psychos they were supposed to be.
You know, it made me think a lot of, to a degree, of Rob Zombie's Devil Rejects, how it's kind of like these despicable characters, but somehow by the end of the film, you're kind of, for some reason, on their side or relating to them in a certain way, because just how the movie ends up, and it's always tricky to have characters like that that you can kind of manipulate the audience with.
Right. There's only really two other actual characters in the movie. You've got the couple that the psychos are chasing down. That's Megan Spencer as Becky, and Paul Harrington as David. I thought, you know, probably Megan Spencer was, you know, probably the best actor in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'll be honest, she's got a face like a foot.
Yeah, she was. Definitely some realism there. Because
definitely. And at the end of the picture, when they show like childhood photos of the main four people, I felt so bad for her because it's like the girl never looked no better, even when she was a child.
Right. Yeah, she does give a good performance here.
Yeah, she's by far the best actor in the film. And, you know, inversely, probably the worst actor in the film is Paul Harrington. As kind of her impending date rapist.
Which kind of helps you hate him, because he's supposed to be kind of a despicable character. It's like, it just makes you hate him even more.
Yeah, he definitely was. I mean, this is a pretty interesting little piece of exploitation. I can definitely see how it came out of kind of the, you know, 1970s exploitation era. You know, I can see how it kind of evolved out of there, as well as, you know, like I said, you know, Last House on the Left. And there is a rape scene in the movie, and some of it looked very much like shot for shot, or trying to be shot for shot, remaking of the rape scene from I Spit on Your Grave.
Yeah, which, you know, I mentioned earlier, the kind of the 70s exploitation style, it's almost like, it's kind of like a drive-in style movie from the 70s, but for the home video age.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I actually got in touch with Mr. Savage and asked him if there's anything about this movie he'd like to share with us. And he had a couple interesting things that I want to share with the listeners.
Cool.
The scene where JD, as you mentioned, gets hit by a car, that was real. He really got smacked by that car, and that makes sense to me with Australian filmmakers. They often will kind of go that extra mile. And especially when it comes to cars.
Right. Yeah.
That makes sense. This also took about a year to shoot. And you can kind of see that, especially if you watch Cullen's hair. Because at some points it looks black.
Yeah.
And at some points it looks brown.
Right.
And I mean, with one scene to another, it definitely would like switch up where you could tell his dye had faded out or something.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I thought was very interesting, and we're talking about how there's, you know, rape and murder and kind of general.
Dogs.
Well, that's dogs. Yes, dogs. That's my dog making her first appearance on the show. He said that he had an interesting conversation with a fan of Marauders once. He was premiering the movie we're going to talk about next, Sensitive New Age Killer. And the fan said to them, "I want you to know that Marauders is my blueprint for living. It changed my life." When he tried to find out more, the fan just simply left it at that. This is kind of a little scary proposition. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I don't know whether it means that, you know, you've got to hunt down bad people or what.
It's the kind of person you just kind of smile and nod at and just kind of walk backwards slowly. All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, basically so. So, I mean, I thought it was a pretty interesting film. This was the... I actually watched this one second, I'm definitely just after this, you know, after seeing this movie and the next one we're going to talk about. I mean, he definitely knows how to shoot a film.
Oh yeah,
and that's really what this film left me with overall. I was like, you know, the acting might not have been so good, the, you know, dialogue wasn't so hot, some of the, you know, action moments weren't all that, but the look of it was spot on.
Which, you know, the fact that it's a shot on video movie shouldn't really dissuade anybody from checking the film out, because I've seen quite a few shot on video movies. I kind of have a love-hate relationship with a lot of them. That's, I like to check them out, and then after I watch, I go, God, why did I spend an hour and a half watching that movie? You know, but this one is by far probably the best shot on video movie for to come out of the 80s that I've ever seen.
No doubt. I mean, you get movies that are shot on video now, shot on like mini DV and stuff like that by some of the independent filmmakers, and they don't take the time to light shots or set them up properly or make sure they have sound or, you know, make sure that the, you know, reflection of the cameraman's not in a window or something like that. And you can definitely tell that Mark Savage took the time to do that kind of thing. Because honestly, if you had told me it was shot on film, I probably would have believed it.
Right. Yeah, because it almost seems like for all, you know, conventional purposes, that's basically what he was trying to do. Because with a lot of these other shot on video cameras, or shot on video films, the ones even now, it's like, I have a video camera, so I'm going to make a movie kind of thing, where it's like, you know, Mark, he'd been making films, short films for quite a bit prior to Marauders, little short films he did with his brother and such. But, you know, so obviously he was going into this going, I'm going to make a legitimate movie, not just go, hey, everybody, I got a video camera. I want to make a movie. I mean, there's probably a little bit of that going on with Marauders, because, you know, it's obviously a lot of he worked with a lot of his friends and stuff in the film, but even the ones shot today on the digital video cameras, it just seems like, yeah, just because you got a video camera, you know, and you know how to edit the film, doesn't mean that you should be making movies.
No, it doesn't necessarily make you a filmmaker. Right. I mean, somebody who's going to actually take the time and put it together, no matter what kind of medium they're using, you know, whether it was, you know, people putting together little movies with Super 8 or people putting together movies with big giant VHS cameras or people shooting on, you know, DV now, the people who take the time to put together a proper film and make it look good, those are the directors that, you know, actually, you know, have some promise, and, you know, people are going to pay attention to their films. If you put on a product that doesn't look good and doesn't sound good, and then nobody's going to pay attention to it. I mean, people realize that, you know, first films are what they are. But if you don't take your time to try to make your best impression with that film, then you're wasting not only your viewers' time, but your time as well.
Exactly. And what makes Mark Savage a great director is, you know, this even goes into the next film we're going to talk about, that he does such incredible work for what the budget that he had, this very small budget that he has, and you can just tell that there's effort. I mean, it's like if you can, you know, you can go and make a movie and you can have a, you know, what, you know, it's just a small budget. But if you're not putting, it so shows when the director's not putting an effort into the film. It's just something that they're trying to make for money or whatever. But when there's, you can totally tell when there's a legitimate effort being made, and that stands out in all of its films.
Right. I mean, sometimes people say, you know, like, oh, he only had this much budget, but you could see every penny of it on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even sure that Mark really had a budget for this one.
No.
I think it was just like catch as catch can, but you could tell that not just every penny that he had went into this, but his blood, sweat, tears, just everything he had to offer this film, he put into it. And it shows, and there's a good reason why he's still making films now.
Right. And so my last thing I want to say on this is that basically just don't write it off because it's shot in video. Because, I mean, if you're comparing it to movies like Redneck Zombies and Video Violence and the Woodchipper Massacre and movies like that, they were just, you know, really horrible stuff. I mean, I get a certain kick out of them because they are so horrible, but, I mean, this is miles and miles above those films.
I definitely agree with that. I'm trying to think of the one movie that I want to compare it to, and for some reason it is slipping my mind because I am totally prepared here. Oh yes, Deadbeat at Dawn.
Oh yeah.
I mean, definitely. I mean, if you like Deadbeat at Dawn, this is not quite as over the top as that, but in a similar vein. And I definitely say also another one where, you know, like Jim Van Bieber, you know, he definitely had a vision. He was, you know, putting all his work he could into making it, and it shows. So I think we've both said all we need to say about this. So all we need to do is hit this one with a rating. So Rev, tell me what you think.
It's kind of a tough call. Why don't you go over what our rating system means here before we jump into this?
Yes. For any new listeners, we have a three-pronged rating system. We have Cinematic Heaven, which these are must-see films. These are things that you have to go out and check out. They're definitely worth your time and worth your dime. The second level is the Purgatory of Lost Films. These are good films to, you know, check out on DVD, or if they seem to be striking your fancy or whatever, but, you know, they're not going to be for everybody, and you know, there's, you know, reasons not to see them maybe as much or as to see them. The lowest rating is, of course, just simple damnation. And those are movies you have no business watching. We had no business reviewing them for you, but we did. And so far, luckily, we haven't reviewed one of those yet. But it's coming. I'm sure it's coming. I'll go ahead since you're still thinking about it. I'm going to put this one in the Purgatory of Lost Films. As good as I think it is, and as strong an opening effort it is, it's just not going to appeal to a lot of people. Not only because it was shot on video, but also, you know, a lot of people are going to see kind of the low-budget kind of psychos in Australia and just not be able to get into it. I'll admit, even a little bit at the beginning of it, I was kind of like, I don't know what's going on here. And it really took me about halfway into the movie before I really started appreciating the film, even though I appreciated the look of it right off. I wasn't really sure if the narrative was going to be something that would hook me, and it took almost half the film before it did.
Yeah, I felt the same way. So, yeah, I'd probably have the same feeling, because, yeah, it mainly, like you said, it's not going to appeal to a wide audience. There's going to be people are going to watch it that would be not as patient as we were.
Right. I mean, if you like films like Deadbeat at Dawn, if you really like Australian exploitation pictures, this is one that you need to check out. Otherwise, well, I think Mark Savage might have some better films up his sleeve for you to check out. And we might just be talking about one of those when we come back in just a minute.
And you know what? I'm going to end it right now. We are really finished.
But you know...
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth, that's a dead man, or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man, or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me.
And we're back again, and you just heard the trailer for Mark Savage's more recent film, Sensitive New Age Killer, also known as Snack.
Putting great use to Ennio Morricone's theme from the gunfight at Red Sands, A Gringo Like Me.
That's indeed, which you'll get to hear a little bit of at the end of our program, a little bit more of that. And, I guess we'll get right into it. System New Age Killer, do you have a year on that?
2000.
2000, so fairly recent. And you got a little synopsis to give us?
After he witnessed a mob hit by a local strong arm called the Snake, that's Frank Bren, Paul Motor, pledged his life to being a contract killer. While trying to make a name for himself, Paul gets pitted against the same man who once inspired his profession. Meanwhile, his sidekick and friend George, Kevin Hopkins, looks to screw Paul over at every turn.
This movie is definitely a giant leap forward as far as his production values and everything. I believe this is the first movie he actually made on film. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was his biggest budget film to date.
Right.
It definitely shows. It's got a great glossy kind of look to it, while still keeping kind of that gritty 70s exploitation feel that we like so much at Marauders.
Right.
This movie, I really enjoyed this because it's got just a twisted, dark, dark sense of humor.
That it does.
It's pretty interesting. I really enjoyed Paul's character. They don't go so far as to really make him like very extremely like, you know, nail on the head sensitive or new age, but you can definitely tell he's not your classic hitman type guy.
No, definitely not. It's funny you pointed out about the character who played the actress who played Becky in the previous film, and that's kind of what I kind of like about his films. He really does go for realism with the people, and they're very real looking people. They're not like, you know, matinee idols.
Oh, that's definitely true. And everybody in this film is really good. There's a lot of good acting going on here. I mean, Paul Motor is really good. I really like his kind of cohort, George, who is maybe not as much of his friend as he seems to be.
Right.
That he's played by Kevin Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed all the screen time that guy had. George takes some very interesting turns with some mother issues, shall we say.
It's funny, through most of the film, you don't really understand why he's the sidekick to this guy. You're like, why does he need this guy? But it's explained later in the movie. I won't give it away. But for the first half of the film, like, why is he keeping this guy around?
Right. But basically, I mean, the film revolves around he's got like one last chance to pull a big job if he wants to become a famous hitman. And I really enjoyed all the kind of, this has got a lot of shootouts in it.
Yeah, very Sam Peckinpah, John Woo style, like, gunfights, yeah.
Right. One note I had here, I just wrote down that it took the bullet ballet and kind of showed off the absurdity of it. I mean, there were points where people were shooting each other from like 2 feet away, just like expending round after round, and like nobody was getting hit.
The not to give anything away, but the ending is kind of what you're talking about there. They really go to the extreme, and that's actually the person that he has a shootout with is Colin Savage.
Yes, and Colin was I believe billed as the indestructible hitman.
Or the hitman that can't shoot a fucking thing.
Yeah, that might have been a more apt description. But I really enjoyed those scenes because, you know, being such a fan of Wu and a lot of the Asian gun ballet pictures, I've always thought, you know, as cool as those things looked, it's like, how is it possible that everybody in this room is not dead a lot faster? And so this kind of poked at that a little bit, and I really enjoyed that, and I think that was one of the highlights of the film to me.
Yeah, what we're describing makes it sound, I mean, it is a funny movie, but it's certainly not a straightforward comedy, because it's certainly not a lighthearted thing. It's a very dark film, but yeah, it definitely has its dose of pitch black humor.
Yeah, it does. I think that both the absurdity of some of the gunfight scenes and some of the dark humor, if you really don't like your humor really, really dark, almost like a dark slapstick humor, then you may not, you know, dig this. But for me, I mean, this kind of zeroed in on exactly what I find funny.
You know, this, I give the folks out there a little bit of an example here of something that I found incredibly funny in the film that probably some others might not. There's a scene with, what's the character's name? George, Kevin Hopkins, where I think we mentioned that he's kind of got some mommy issues, and he's sitting at a coffee table snorting the ashes of his dead mother while watching a videotape of his father's suicide.
Right.
So that probably does not sound very funny.
But it is.
It's hilarious.
I mean, if you like your humor twisted, I mean, it doesn't get a whole lot more twisted than that. But it also has some kind of like simple moments of humor that were straight up humor that made me laugh, even though they were absurd. Like when Paul is looking for his wallet and his wife says, "Oh, it's probably behind the fridge." I mean, not only is it hilarious that his wallet would be behind the fridge, but why is it that your wife always knows where your shit is at?
True.
Because I can lose anything, and my wife will be like, "Oh, it's right here." I'm like, "Oh, how the fuck did you know that?" And so I really it kind of just enjoyed that kind of little moment of kind of marital bliss there that happened. And it's just a brief character thing to it, but I thought it was very good.
Yeah, I mean, on top of the great action in the film, and there's also, you know, the love triangle thing going on, and there's so many levels to the film that it's not something you can really peg, you know.
Right. Unfortunately, I do think once again the one thing that bothered me in the film was the score. It was again this weird synthy blippy thing that I don't know. I wanted like Morricone the whole time or something like that, to kind of give it a grandeur to this guy's kind of like simple hitman life.
You know, it must not have left an impression on me, because I watched the film yesterday, and I can't even remember beyond the Morricone song
any of the stuff in it. Yeah, I mean, this one hit on all cylinders for me. I mean, it really took kind of a lot of the stuff that Marauders had and kind of just took it way up to that next level. I know there were a lot of intervening films between the two. But I mean, it definitely shows that, you know, that he had a lot of growth, and he continued to work as a filmmaker and strive to make his films better every step of the way.
Definitely. There's this is whereas, you know, with the last film, I think there's, it's, you know, less of an audience for that kind of film. This one, I mean, as dark as it is and as strange as it is, I think it has way more appeal.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think people who like, you know, Quentin Tarantino's work, mm-hmm. or Robert Rodriguez, or somebody like that is going to really get into this movie and like the kind of point of view it's coming from.
Yeah, in fact, you know, bringing up those directors, Mark Savage is actually, I think he captures that 70s exploitation vibe way better than Tarantino and Rodriguez when they're trying to do it for like the Grindhouse stuff. Because even that was what kind of my big problem. I mean, I liked the Grindhouse movies, but the one problem I had with them was they still looked like big budget Hollywood movies.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to not to look like big budget Hollywood movies, whereas, you know, Mark Savage is like, that's the real thing, you know?
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, Of you know, not to get off on a tangent, but of the two of Grindhouse, you know, I really enjoyed Planet Terror a little bit better, even though it kind of had a slicker look. It was more of a fun film to me. Death Proof was kind of the misstep in Tarantino's career for me so far, because I wasn't real thrilled with how talky it was in kind of that 70s vibe, because the two didn't seem to mesh to me.
Yeah, I mean, like, again, not to get on, go off on some, but I like them both, but I actually really like Death Proof. And I think the problem with that is those two movies should not have been put together. And certainly Death Proof should not have been the second movie.
Yeah, that's long been my contention, that why it struck me as a film that I had problems with is I think Death Proof should have came first, because it built to a good climax. And then Planet Terror really starts off pretty, you know, hot and heavy to begin with. So, you know, the build was still going on. While if Planet Terror ended and then you go back down into Tarantino talkiness, I don't know. It was a real drop off to me, and it didn't really work. If the two films had been reversed, it would have worked a lot better for me.
And I think there's a misconception that pretty much exploitation films all appeal to horror fans, where it's like, right, that's not really necessarily the case. There's horror fans that are just like horror, and I think they with right. the Grindhouse, they saw the zombie movie, and then it was like this other like 70s exploitation, like you know, kind of film was second, and it was just like, what the hell is this? So
right, but I mean, there are a good amount of film fans that I think their first love is horror.
Mm-hmm.
And they also like some other, you know, genre things as well.
Right.
And I know that's, I mean, that's kind of how I feel too. I mean, horror really got me into genre film, mm-hmm. In general.
Same
but,
here.
You know, I definitely like a lot of different kinds. But, I know quite a few people that they only really like horror.
Right.
Now, getting back to Mark Savage's film, because mm-hmm. we're way off topic. I think this is one that if you really appreciate genre film, outside of the horror milieu, and really like, you know, action movies and exploitation pictures and, you know, John Woo movies and things like that, then this is really just, it's going to appeal to you throughout. And it's just going to have little moments where you go like, oh, that's cool, that's kind of like this, or oh, that kind of reminds me of that. And but not without ever feeling like it's ripping off anything. It more feels like it's riffing on it than ripping.
Right, yeah. Ultimately, it's got a very original feel to it. The character of Snake was something I really enjoyed. The scenes with him and the main guy, Paul.
Yes.
Yeah, the scene in the motel room. Mm-hmm. And Snake has this like really cool gimmick with the stethoscope. I thought was pretty mm-hmm. cool.
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say, but when the snake kills people, he's an elderly man now, And he kind of can only get satisfaction from it by using a stethoscope to listen to the last beats of the heartbeat
right.
as it fades out. And I thought that was an excellent touch, something I've not seen in anything else, but something that just rang very true in a genre film type of way.
Speaking of originality, that's why I was kind of bringing that up. There was a lot of stuff like that. I thought there was very original, even George with his mommy issues and stuff like that. So it was... all around, a pretty damn good flick.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's about all I have to say about it. You have any other notes, sir?
Yeah, before we get out of his Savage's films here, tell everybody that he does have a YouTube page, youtube.com/user/SavageCinema, cinema with an S, and you can find all the trailers for his films on there.
Right, and he let me know, and I believe this trailer is probably on there. He's in production on a new film called The Cloth Dagger with Michael Tierney, who is, of course, Lawrence Tierney's nephew. A lot of people will know Lawrence Tierney from Reservoir Dogs.
Mm.
He played, what was his name? Was it Joe? I can't remember.
It's been a while.
Toby Chan. And Renee Bolt, who played the brunette dominatrix in Sensitive New Age Killer, is also in that film. And that's going to be wrapping up in August. So I will look forward to checking out that film and many more films by Mark Savage. Definitely, this is a director and a couple of films that you brought up to check out. And I'm really glad you did, because it's definitely made me a Mark Savage fan.
Oh, yeah, definitely good. I mean, we should also probably mention that the Marauders and Sensitive New Age Killers are available on a box set that also include Defenseless and Stained, four movies, and pretty much all of his short films that he made with his brother. It's pretty entertaining stuff, and I believe, they are available on Netflix, so
yep,
check it out.
Yeah, definitely do, and for my rating of Sensitive New Age Killer, honestly, this is it's not a perfect film, but for me, it just totally entertained me. I was laughing, I was really into the action, I was into the quirky characters, and I'm going to send this one directly to Cinematic Heaven.
Oh yeah, me too. This is everything I pretty much ask for in a film, and it had huge exploding squibs and from the gunshots and titties and violence, and it's just a gorgeous film. Yeah, definitely goes to Cinematic Heaven.
It does indeed. So there we go. That's two films from director Mark Savage, and we definitely enjoy both of them. We like the second one better, but we definitely encourage you to go out and check him out, whether you buy the box set or rent it from Netflix or whatever. Definitely, this is a filmmaker that has a passion for his work, and you should support him.
Definitely.
So we are going to leave you here with a little trailer for our Bizarre Treasure, and we will be back in a moment to talk about it.
Our galaxy is split into two warring factions, our own and the one ruled by the evil Count Zarthan from the League of the Dark Worlds.
The Count has created a weapon so vast, so huge, that it would take a whole planet to conceal it. You must sail to the haunted stars. Find the Count's secret planet and destroy it.
All right, and this week for Bizarre Treasures, we are going to be bringing you two films. We've each got a movie for you. As always, our Bizarre Treasures can be picked up at cinemadebizarre.com. That's cinema-de-bizarre.com. The best place for all your hard-to-find genre film needs. So as you heard in that trailer there, I'm going to be talking about a little film called Star Crash. Kind of in the wake of Star Wars, there were a million different kind of takeoffs that came out. And this one actually came out I believe, a year after Star Wars, 1978. That might have been 2 years. I think Star Wars was 77, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this came by way of Luigi Cozzi, who, I believe, he did Contamination.
Yes.
As well as several other films that are not all that good. Cozzi is kind of a filmmaker that is a little hit and miss. But Star Crash, I think, is one of his hits. So let me give you a little synopsis here. Stellastar is a smuggler. And along with her, she's played by Carolyn Monroe. And along with her partner, Acton, Marjo Gortner, she makes a living salvaging what she can from deep space. The duo is finally caught by the chief of police, Thor, Robert Tessier, and police robot, Elle, voiced by Hamilton Camp. She gets sentenced to hard labor, but they get released from jail by the Galactic Emperor, strangely played by Christopher Plummer, to aid in finding a missing ship which has been attacked by Count Zarthon's forces. Count Zarthon, played by Joe Spinell.
Yeah.
The Emperor dispatches the duo along with Thor and Al to discover the secret weapon Zarthon is wielding and see if his son Simon, played by David Hasselhoff,
the Hoff,
has survived the attack. Along the way, they must battle Amazons, giant robots, and roving bands of Neanderthals before facing off against Zarthon with the fate of the galaxy on the line. Of all the kind of sci-fi takeoff, half-assed Star Wars movies I have ever seen, I really like this one best. It is way over the top. It is seriously campy. The secret weapon looks like you got caught in the light show from the Fillmore East. It's just kind of glowing red lights, and then people fall down for no apparent reason.
Right.
I really like it, and this has got just a stellar cast to it, not to make a pun, but I guess I did anyway.
Yeah.
Carolyn Monroe, a lot of people will know her from maybe the Dr. Fives movies. I probably like her best in a couple of movies she made with her Star Crash co-star, Joe Spinell. Maniac and The Last Horror Show.
Yeah.
Both excellent, excellent movies. And it is really weird to see Monroe as kind of a heroic character and Spinell as like an evil space dictator with like a crazy beard going on and stuff. He's so over the top. It's just insane.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, as far as like the Italian made sci-fi, low-budget sci-fi movies, they were all, trying to be, Star Wars or Buck Rogers or something like that. Yeah, this is definitely one of the better ones. This and the humanoid or two that I really, really dig.
Yeah, it's a good little film, and definitely if you like 70s sci-fi, this is one you should definitely check out. Like I said, the top to bottom, the cast is really good. The effects are actually even pretty decent in this one, other than maybe the secret weapon. So the giant robot and things like that actually look fairly good.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's I think a lot of people just write it off altogether, which, you know, I guess, I mean, is somewhat fair if you're such a stickler for such things. But I mean, if you like these kind of movies, I mean, if you can get over the fact that it's completely ripping off, you know, Star Wars and a few other sci-fi movies, I mean, if you can just get into it for what it is, then you should be able to enjoy it.
Right. And if you can tell me of another movie that has David Hasselhoff, Joe Spinell, and Christopher Plummer in it, I will give you something special, because it's absolutely just crazy that those three guys are in the same movie. I have no idea what Christopher Plummer was doing in here. It seems very odd. But that is that's about all I have to say about Star Crash. Definitely one you should check out over at Cinema de Bizarre. So tell me, Rev, you've got a pick for us this week as well. What are you going to talk about?
Well, my film also has a very fetching leading lady in it as well, sent to Berger. The movie is When Women Lost Their Tails from 1972. Directed by Pasquale Festa Campanelli, who also did Hitchhike with David Hess and Franco Nero. Mm. Like I said, it stars Senta, but also Frank Wolf, Mario Adorf has a small part, and Lando Bazanka.
Well, that is a name right there.
That's an awesome name,
dude. It is. Anybody with the real name Lando gets some props from me.
And with a score by Ennio Morricone, which you should be hearing right now. A very playful little ditty, that very un-Morricone sounding, actually. It's basically, it's a comedy. It's about cavemen, Feely, played by Senta Berger, and the other cavemen from, this is actually a sequel to When Women Had Tails, which I like, but not as much as this one. And that is currently not available. Cinema de Bizarre, but this one is. Living a carefree, if not boring, life inside a dinosaur skeleton. But when a con man named Ham, played by Lando Bazanka, who was also in Fulci's The Eroticist, introduced them to the concept of currency and economics, as well as capitalism, their lives fall apart. On top of that, Feely starts to fall in love with Ham. This is really, I mean, we've talked about this before, about Italian comedies, and I don't care for a lot of them, but damn if this one doesn't make me laugh. It's very silly. It's very playful, but it makes me laugh. So I mean, it's got enough, you know, pratfalls and slapstick, I guess, to appeal to my American sensibilities.
Right. This is not one I've seen, but definitely starring anybody named Lando Bazanka as a character named Ham. And let me tell you, I fell in love with Ham a long time ago, because I'm really big on the swine. I know it's a dirty animal, but it's just good.
Definitely.
This is one I'm going to definitely be putting on my short list of films to pick up from Cinema de Bizarre.
And I pointed out it goes over the pros and cons of capitalism and communism and stuff like that, but it does it in a really funny way. It's not to make that sound like it's some sort of like thinking man's kind of movie. It does it in a really silly way, and it probably won't appeal to everyone's sense of humor, but it sure did to mine. And it's the sequel. Like I said, it's a sequel to When Women Had Tails, which I didn't like as much. But the first one is shot on location, and the sequel all takes place on a soundstage.
Nice,
which gives it a really cheesy, like Flintstones-esque vibe that made the film. It changed the whole kind of vibe of the film from the first one. And I actually saw these. Both these films back when I was a teenager on late night cable, like not even like pay cable, like late night, like syndication channel. Right. That was like one of the late movie. And I was, you know, up with, for some reason, and watched both films. And I was just like, wow, those are pretty good. And, you know, it's all dubbed, and the dubbing's horrible. If over at Cinema de Bizarre's YouTube page, I do have a clip for that. You can look for that. If you go to YouTube and type in "scene from When Women Lost Their Tails," it should pop up for you.
All right. Well, there you go. There's a couple of good selections from Cinema de Bizarre. So as always, go over And tell Mark and the folks over at Cinema de Bazaar that the boys from Sinful Cinema have sent you, and that is www.cinema-de-bazaar.com. So now that we've done that, we have feedback this week. That's right. Yay. For a second week in a row, people thought enough of us to write in. So here's a little letter from Emily, and Emily has a great little blog she runs over at www.deadlydollshouse.blogspot.com, and Emily has definitely a taste for some of the lower budget affairs that come out, and she has turned me on to several terrible movies. Fear of Clowns being probably the number one there. If you have not read her review of Fear of Clowns, I definitely recommend it. So here's what she writes. She says, "Hi, fellas. I'm a little behind on the podcast, but I wanted to drop a line. Whatever that means. This is an email, and there's no cue behind it. That I've really been enjoying your discussions thus far. I'm loving the mix of obscure 70s cinema and more modern horror. A few random points. Number one, Exorcist 3. I remember watching this on cable when I was about 11 years old, being surprisingly freaked out. I haven't seen it in years, but there was definitely something about it that made me nervous to walk into a dark room, or at least for that one night of childhood. Number two, Frontiers. Very good for what it is, but it's rather frustrating to get this fascinating political lead-up and lose that so quickly in the face of good old-fashioned backwoods torture. Xavier Jens can clearly craft a good horror movie, but I wonder how much more potential that near-future dystopia offered before the bloodshed began. And number three, Martyrs. Great film? I still don't know. As I've only watched it once so far, what I mostly loved about it was how the film constantly played with the subgenres of horror, starting as sort of a J-horror ghost story in an orphanage, switching to home invasion, then torture porn, than something completely of its own. Compare that to something like a recent low-budget film I watched called Broken. You'd recognize it by the fact its cover art is almost identical to Inside, which is also extremely well-made for its price tag but offers nothing new. A man kidnaps a woman and makes her slave in an empty forest. There's a lot of cutting and female screams. Then it ends with more bloodshed and even louder screams. When I follow watching Martyrs with a film like that, Martyrs simply becomes a masterpiece by commenting on the stale state of torture cinema. That's all for now. Keep up the good work and happy days to all. Emily."
Very good points.
Yes.
All points there.
Indeed. Definitely go back and watch The Exorcist 3 if you haven't seen it in a while. It's surprisingly still extremely freaky.
But we were talking about this last podcast, right? It was the somebody was bad talking it. Who was it?
I don't remember.
It was freaking talking about it. That's
yes.
Right. He was talking about that. None of the sequels were worth the crap, kind right. of a thing. Right?
Yeah, he is incorrect on that point.
True.
Exorcist 3 is a fine film, and yeah, definitely, Emily. I encourage you to check that out again. As far as Frontiers, I can definitely see the point. I guess some of the political lead in and everything and some of the politics of the movie, until I kind of did some research after the fact, kind of just flew right by me.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, clearly Jens, I mean, like we talked about when we talked about the film, I mean, he's gone on to make Hitman. In America, which was not such a good film. So he hasn't really lived up to the potential that film really showed in the first place. So
I'm afraid he's the kind of director that might go into the direction of style over substance.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. I think he was trying to have some substance in the first film, but, you know, perhaps you know, there wasn't as much there as maybe even he was implying there was there.
Right.
But still, I find that a pretty entertaining film because of the bloodshed and whatnot.
Yep.
As far as Martyrs, great points on Martyrs as far as, you know, how it mixes up the subgenres and everything. And definitely when you compare it to, and I'm not a big fan of the term torture porn, but when you compare it to a lot of the other torture porn offerings, it stands head and shoulders above, you know, most of the other stuff that's out there, if not all of it. I mean, it's really an incredibly well-made film, in my opinion.
Definitely. Yeah, it's pretty damn good horror flick.
Yep. So, yeah, Emily, you know, check that out again and, you know, get back to us. Let us know what you thought on second viewing. And thanks for writing in. We definitely appreciate it. And if you would like to hear your emails read out on the air, you should send us a line at sinfulcinema@charter.net. And we would love to hear from you. This is the second week in a row we have got one email. Next week we want to shoot for two. So get those keyboards working and give us a couple emails. I also want to announce we have a little contest I have kicked off here. We need reviews on iTunes because people don't know how awesome we are. If they just look at the thing, they might see our graphic looks awesome and the name of our shows look awesome and everything, but they're like, they don't have any reviews. How do I know that they're awesome? Well, the way they know that we're awesome is that you folks tell them we're awesome. So what I need you to do is the first five folks who, or however many, leave a review on iTunes before the end of March. I'm going to put those names in a hat, and I'm going to get up a little prize pack of movies and send it out to one of you lucky people. So, yes, it is bribery. I am not beyond it. But it's not definite bribery. It's just a chance at bribery.
Yep, nothing wrong with that.
No, nothing at all. So definitely, you know, you're already there downloading it on iTunes. I'm sure a lot of you are, so just take a minute. You know, rate the show, leave a little feedback. We definitely would appreciate it, and it'll help more people download the show and grow and everything. We're getting up around 500 subscribers, which after a month just blows my mind. And I want to thank everybody out there for hanging in there and making it to episode 5 and still listening to the show and everything.
We should, you know, tell all those beautiful, beautiful subscribers that we have that, you know, you can always follow us on our blogs, too.
Oh, that's true. We do have blogs. You can find me at www.thelightningbugslayer.com. And I've got lots of great stuff coming up. Wednesday, I'll be kicking off Hitch on the Hump again. So we got that to look forward to. I'll be looking at Frenzy. Later this week, I'll be looking at the silent movie, The Call of Cthulhu. And towards the end of the week, Sundays, I'm looking at Shatner films with a month-long celebration I like to call You Don't Know Shat. How about you? Where are you at?
Well, you can find me at ReverendPhantom.com. And yeah, I don't have as much of a schedule as you do.
I'm anal about my schedule. It is not good.
My next live review or video review, whatever you want to call it, will be for Cannibal Apocalypse.
Oh, nice. I just watched that one recently, and I really, really like that movie.
Great flick. Should have that up hopefully by next weekend, and probably my next written review should be for Fulci's The Psychic.
Nice. I know you said you were going to kind of look at a lot more horror this month. Since you've kind of been on, you did the Russ Meyer thing and then the blaxploitation thing. So that's great that you're kind of getting back around to the horror stuff this month.
Yep, I neglected the horror there for too long. And plus, I mentioned this in a comment to somebody the other day. After watching a whole month of blaxploitation, they're such fun films, and they make me so happy that I actually have to watch some dark and depressing shit in March so I can, like, level things out.
Right. Before we sign off here, there's a couple other blogs I want to mention, some friends of ours. You should definitely check out Chuck Norris AteMyBaby.blogspot.com. That's Matt Suzaka's blog. And you should check out the Uranium Cafe. I believe it's at theuraniumcafe.com. That is Uranium Willie's excellent blog. He's a good friend of ours. And, of course, check out thevaultofhorror.com. Where the newest episode of Confessions of the Dark, I believe, had Matt Suzaka on it. I don't think there's been a newer one since then. And maybe there has. I'm not sure. But either way,
I believe he posted an interview with Roddy Piper.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There is an interview with Roddy Piper talking about They Live. I forgot all about that. So definitely something you should go over there and check it out. Quite a little... nice little piece for B-Soul to be putting up. So those are all great things. And if you're looking for more great horror blogs, you should definitely head over to the Horror Blogger Alliance. Carl from ILikeHorrorMovies.com has kind of banded all the horror bloggers together. There's great debates going on about different things. I know I have a debate coming up here shortly over is Argento overrated? And you'll have to check out that website to see what I think about that. But I think you can probably guess. yeah, you should definitely check that out. Check out some of our favorite podcasts. You should check out The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema and the Cadaver Lab podcast. Both great, great podcasts you should be listening to if you're not. And if you're not listening to us, because... you know, first you should be listening to us, and then,
right.
then those other guys, of course. But I suppose that's going to round it out for this week. So, you got anything else, sir?
No, I think I'm about to blow my throat out here anyway, so I should shut the hell up.
All right, so Reverend's going to shut the hell up. Of course, I could keep going talking, but you people have probably had enough of me by now anyway. So, I will just say, until next week... keep sinning.
You're a terrible sinner.